Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Starseed Radio Academy, empowering Starseed to better serve the planet.
Welcome to Starseed Radio Academy. It's Tuesday, August 23rd, 2011, and I'm your host, Arielle Taylor, with my co-host, Lavendar. Sierra's on vacation this week, but she'll be back next week. Tonight, we are honored to welcome William Henry to our show. During over 25 years of research, William Henry has pursued a startling but undeniable fact that throughout history and across widely diverse cultures, there is an absolutely seamless tradition of the existence of portals and gateways to the stars, which have been preserved in the art and the myths of each era and place. Advanced beings that came from the light of the vastness of the Milky Way and beyond did so through these gateways. They left the secrets of a Stargate way, which he calls the Gate of Eternity, for us to discover. In his quest to discover the secrets of this Gate of Eternity, he searched museums, libraries, and temples of the world to uncover and follow the visual code of the Gate of Eternity. What he discovered and brought to the world's attention is truly amazing. The symbolism used by the ancient Egyptians to depict their gods traveling the stars matches illustrations used by modern science to symbolize stargates and wormholes. Stargates, or wormholes, are cosmic gateways that theoretically link regions of the universe millions of light years apart and allow nearly instantaneous communication between these regions. On his website, williamhenry.net, you'll be fascinated with the correlations he's made between seemingly separate eras and civilizations. He's the host of his own radio show called Revelations Stargate Radio, and his research is documented in 16 books and numerous DVD programs, including the best-selling Morph and Soul Rising. He's also working on a book with our guest from last week, Dr. Carmen Bolter. See more on his website. Again, it's williamhenry.net. Later, near the middle of the show, we'll get an update about the Rennes Le Château Mary Magdalene Bloodline Mystery Tour, which is starting October 2nd through the 8th. So many of our audience and community contacted Renee Barnett, the producer of Bloodline the movie, and asked to go with her the next time she visits that sacred area in France, that this tour kind of planned itself. Renee's co-director, Gloria Amendola, will be stopping by to tell us more about it. We'd like to thank Purple Sage and Tammy for hosting the chat room and switchboard tonight and helping to make this show possible. Purple Sage will be forwarding your questions to us from the chat room for those who can't call in. And if you can call, our number is 917-889-8292. Then press 1 so we know you have something to say. You can also listen on your computer at blogtalkradio.com/starseed-radio-academy. Please stay on our topic this evening with your questions. If you haven't yet, please click follow on our show page, and if you like the show, tell a friend. On our main site, which is starseedhotline.com, we have a lot of vital information for Starseed in our vault of knowledge. The entire site is coded for Starseed activation. We also have a support forum for Starseed at starseedhotline.ning.com. Plus, we're on iTunes if you'd like to download our shows to go. Lavendar and William Henry will be joining us in just a few moments, but first I'd like to let you know that if you want to contact us privately, the toll-free number for our website is 888-881-0881. If you'd like our Stage 1 Starseed confirmation, you'll get your natal and progress charts plus an MP3 of your reading, pointing out and explaining your star markings if you have them. Our Stage 2 readings are a one-on-one phone consultation, which is available only after your confirmation if you want to go deeper. Make sure your birth info is exact to the minute and include your place of birth as well as your current place of residence. If any of that's missing, it'll delay your reading until we can find out. And don't forget, if you have a birthday coming up, you should know when your 10 hours of power will occur by requesting your solar return timing. Your manifestational ability is amplified 1,000-fold during those 10 hours, so make the most of it. And now I'd like to introduce my co-host, Lavendar.
Hello, Arielle and our listeners. I am so happy that we're going to have William on the show. I've been tracking him for a very long time, and I'm so excited that he's decided to join us this evening. So I'm ready to go if you are.
Okay. I'd like to introduce William Henry. Hi.
Hello. Good evening, ladies. Good evening, everybody.
Good evening.
Well,
welcome.
William, I did look at your site several times, and I'm just very, very thrilled to see the information about Nashville, Tennessee, Athena, the Parthenon, and all the codes that seem to be up in your direction. How long have you lived in Nashville?
I have lived in Nashville for 28 years now. I came here I grew up in Detroit, in the Detroit area, Birmingham, Michigan, and came here to go to college and stayed.
Well, we're so glad that you did. Tell us a little bit about your early childhood, and did you have feelings of knowing things when you were young, and did you have strong intuition growing up?
No, actually, I didn't. I was deep into sports as a kid. I loved golf. I loved football. I loved baseball, and was a voracious reader, mostly reading about sports heroes and that kind of thing. I guess I did have some sort of an aspect of me that was kind of buried in there. I remember on my 33rd birthday, I got a big chunk of Moldavite, and I showed it to my mom, and she said, "Oh, did that come from Idaho?" And I said, "No, it came from actually from Moldavia. It was part of a meteorite." And I said, "Well, why, Mom?" And she said, "Well, don't you remember when you were about 7 years old, we were going through the Craters of the Moon National Park, and we're driving along, and all of a sudden we hear this booming voice from the back of the car saying, 'Stop the car now, Dad.'" And it was me, and I ran out of the car and ran out and stood in the middle of this meteorite field, and my parents were just like, "What is up with our kid?" And so it was just kind of a funny thing, and I actually remember doing that after she said that. But actually, I didn't really start on any kind of a serious kind of spiritual or historical or mythological pursuit until I was in college. I had moved to Nashville to go to a small Southern Baptist school that offered a music business degree. My plan was to become an entertainment lawyer and go to work on Music Row, which is the music business center here in Nashville. There's 39,000 professional songwriters here in town, and they call it Music City, Twang Town, Toon Town, all that kind of thing. It's all about the music business, and I was going to jump into that arena. And the catch was that at this small Southern Baptist school, you had to take Bible study classes in order to get your degree. Well, as I said, I didn't know anything about the Bible. I didn't grow up in a religious family. And so off I went hiking to fulfill a requirement for the course, which was to review a book whose implications would impact Christianity. So went down to the bookstore. This was 1982. There was a brand new book on the shelf. It was an international bestseller at the time. It was called Holy Blood, Holy Grail. And I picked up that book, started flipping through it, and was instantly hooked. Our assignment was to write a 3-page book review of the book that we chose. My book review on Holy Blood, Holy Grail was 44 pages. And after I finished the paper and submitted it, I was actually flunked by my professor, and he asked me if I really wanted to continue going to school at a Southern Baptist college if I believed any of that stuff that was in Holy Blood, Holy Grail. And of course, 28 years later, Dan Brown has sold over 80 million books based on that premise. It's a huge phenomenon for people, and it's still, as Renee Barnett and certainly Gloria Amendola can tell you, Rennes Le Chateau is a very important mystery center, and the story of Jesus and Mary Magdalene is yet untold to this day, and it may well be that there are still remaining some hidden secrets of Jesus and Mary Magdalene, and that's a very tantalizing possibility to me.
Well, once you read Holy Blood, Holy Grail, there's one thing about it, you never can go back. You can't undo what you have read. And I know that happened to a lot of people back in the early 80s when that book came out. And it was the forerunner of awakening people everywhere. So after you've lived in Nashville all these years, what are some of the things that have happened for you there that keep you interested in tracking the center of Nashville and what it means on the grid with the crystal gray ley lines? Give us a little bit more information about what you found out about the mall and about Athena.
Sure, be happy to. One of my early books was called The Atomic Christ. It was about FDR's search for the Holy Grail in 1934. A lot of people know that Adolf Hitler was seeking the secrets of the Grail. Less well known is the fact that FDR, along with his two-term Secretary of Agriculture and third-term Vice President, Henry A. Wallace, along with a Russian mystic and guru named Nicholas Rurik, together reformed the archetypal trio of the three wise men seeking the secrets of the Holy Grail. Rurik had spent the 1920s following Jesus' trail during those 18 missing years after he leaves Palestine and goes through Egypt, Iran, Iraq, on into India, into Mongolia. And he returns with evidence to that he presents to FDR and Wallace that if they send him back to Mongolia, he can find evidence, one, not only of the Holy Grail, but proof of the Second Coming, and also ultimately a connection to the mysterious realm of Shambhala, the realm of the gods, the portal or gate of the gods. Well, there were a series of letters, around 30 of them, that I've decoded, that were written by Henry Wallace to Nicholas Rurik during the course of this expedition. These letters I retrieved from the FDR Library in Hyde Park, New York. They were all written in Holy Grail speak, using terminology drawn from ancient Tibetan Buddhism to Holy Grail language to all esoteric stuff, things that Madame Blavatsky would well understand. And historians had never been able to really fully understand or even decipher what Wallace was saying in these letters. But one of these letters in particular indicated to me that they were going to be returning the results of their search for the Holy Grail to Nashville, Tennessee. And so part of what I had deduced from all of this is that there are these extraordinary depictions, in especially in the Vatican Museum today, that are all dated from about the 2nd century AD to the early 4th century AD, that portray Jesus performing the miracles, turning water into wine, raising Lazarus from the dead, loaves into fishes, so on and so forth. But these depictions are unique in that they portray Jesus with a magic wand performing these miracles. And as I'm looking at this, I'm thinking, well, okay, what happened to that wand? Is this an actual device? And if Jesus is performing the miracles with this wand, then is this in some way connected with the Holy Grail, which is my fundamental premise, that Jesus was an adept. He was an avatar. You could even call him a magi, who knew the secrets of the life force energy upon which the world was built. And of course, FDR and Hitler were both seeking these secrets for the same reason. They wanted to weaponize these secrets. They believed that they could take these universal life energy secrets and develop weapons of mass destruction with them, which was what their ultimate hope was. So I'm putting together this puzzle saying, all right, they're looking for signs of the Second Coming in Mongolia. It's possible that ultimately the Grail is some kind of a magic wand. I mean, maybe even some kind of a Harry Potter type wand, but many, many, many times more powerful than that. Or it's certainly the symbol for this astonishing universal life energy teaching. So lo and behold, get these letters, start looking at them. I'm pointed to Nashville as a possible landing point for these secrets. I start driving around Nashville, just asking my guidance, show me signs of the Holy Grail. And I'm driving along Jefferson Street in downtown Nashville, which sits right beside our state capitol. And I see this giant 20-foot tall red granite monolith with what looks to be a magic wand etched upon its surface. And I pulled over and said, wait a minute, I've seen that before. And I went home and I got out my books on the sacred mountains of Asia, which had one of which had a diagram of mystic Mount Meru. This is the place where Rurik specifically was looking for the secrets of the Grail, because Meru is actually topped by the gateway or portal to Shambhala. So I take the Meru diagram, which resembles some kind of like an antenna or human vertebrae, and I put it side by side with the diagram of the Bicentennial Mall, and what do you know? Which is the location where this rod or wand was located. And what do you know? it's a near perfect match, close enough that everybody who looks at it says, wow, we got to be talking about the same thing. And so I started from that point forward really deeply researching this Bicentennial Mall site. And what it actually is, it's a 2,200-foot-long magician's rod that is laid out and growing on 19 acres at the base of our state capitol. And the really interesting thing about it, or one of the more interesting things about it, is that each of the seven chakras are perfectly marked with appropriate symbolism, all supposedly by chance. But I believe it's the natural design feature of this place, because ultimately Meru, the cosmic axis, the ladder, tower, or stairway to heaven, is within each and every one of us. This wand that Jesus was utilizing, I believe, is actually a symbol for the power that's in every one of us.
Well, yes, and I think that by you discovering this, that it's awakened a lot of people to research. What you do is you put things forward for other researchers to go into other areas. And I think, as I said earlier, I have been following you for some time, and I find that every once in a while I'll go in and see something that you've said on your website, and it has to do with something that I'm researching myself. And, of course, I have been really connected to Athena and the 96 goddess story for some time. And Ariel and I, we went to Nashville several years ago, and we went and stood at the foot of Athena. And I must tell you that just being in the presence of that statue was like a DNA activation of some sort. Wouldn't you say, Ariel?
No doubt.
Yeah. And because of it, we decided that we would, you know, venture further into all of this information, and one thing led to another. And, of course, now we have, you know, the Starseed website. And, of course, we specialize in Starseed and the information about Stargates. So I'm also interested in knowing how you determine what a Stargate is. Would you give us a little definition of what you think a Stargate is?
I'll be happy to. And by the way, I call the Bicentennial Mall site in Nashville Stargate Park, and we can get back to that in a moment. But I define a Stargate on three levels. First, a Stargate is the connection from the heart of one sun or star to the heart of another star or star system. A Stargate, then, is also a place on Earth, a dot of real estate, where the energy or vibration from a star or star system is ringing or singing in the earth, making it energetically alive or more active and more pertinent to that particular star system than other places. And the third definition of a Stargate is that it is actually a transportation portal, a gateway. It can be a shamanic trance portal, or it can be a literal physical gateway in which one could conceivably open a door from this place, from point A, and arrive at point B as if there's nothing in between.
And I noticed on your website you had a picture of the telephone. Tell us a little bit about how you came to put that symbol up on your website.
Well, I have made a unique connection by comparing the shape of the ships of eternity of ancient Egypt. When you look on the walls of certain temples, especially the Temple of Hathor at Dendera, you will see depictions of the gods sailing for eternity on their ships of eternity. They call them the Ark of the Millions of Years, or the Ship of Eternity. And what I noticed many years ago was that the way they portray those ships on the ceilings and on the walls of the temples matches precisely the way modern science portrays a wormhole. I mean, we are talking an exact match. And I don't think that's by coincidence. I believe that what's happening is that modern science is catching up with ancient sacred science. And the reason why we're able to readily identify the shape of the ship of eternity as matching a wormhole is because we must be on the verge of being able to duplicate what we see on these temple walls. So I started with that connection. And then what you see in some of these depictions at various temples is not only do you see the Ark of the Millions of Years resembling a wormhole or what we also would call a Stargate, they're interchangeable, but often you will see these chambers. You will see a god being standing inside a chamber that looks like a phone booth. And in fact, one of the chambers is called the Shetia, which means the tomb of God. And what we're told in ancient Egyptian myth and sacred tradition is that Osiris entered into the tomb of God, the Shetiat, and was transformed as a result of that and became an ascended being, a light being. So I'm thinking, okay, this is a basic idea rooted deep in the subconscious. When you want to talk about time travel today, you show a phone booth. This is based on the popularity of like Doctor Who, Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. Even Superman utilizes the phone booth as a symbol of transformation. So you go back, and I have these on my website, williamhenry.net, in the About William Henry section, where you can see several of these chambers, and you see these gods, notably Osiris, in the chamber being transformed into a god being. You see Hindu star beings or celestial beings in similar type chambers as well. So I'm thinking, okay, so today we utilize the phone booth, and the phone booth in sci-fi symbolizes time travel. It symbolizes traveling through a wormhole, and ultimately it symbolizes the human transformation into a super being, into a celestial being or a star being. So based on that, I just took that one step forward and took the symbol of the telephone, the shape of the telephone, and flipped it horizontally. And what do you know? It looks just like the in and out of a wormhole.
Yeah, it's called, how about E.T. Phone Home?
How about E.T. Phone Home? I mean, if you ever wondered if God has a sense of humor, here it is.
Yes, and also in telephones, they have quartz crystal, and of course quartz crystal is the transmitter that carries the signal to, you know, so many different places. And in my understanding, quartz crystal is the one common denominator that transfers information from planet to planet.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that's very, very interesting. How many trips have you taken to Egypt?
I've taken 7 trips to Egypt.
When was your last trip there?
My last trip was January 2011.
I was there recently.
In the middle of the revolution.
Right. Would you say that inside the sarcophagus and the Great Pyramid, that this could be a place of transference, very much like a phone booth?
I would say so. In fact, I've had my own experience with, let's call it maybe another entity in the King's Chamber of the Great Pyramid that has led me to believe that personally.
Yeah, me too. Okay, great. Ariel, do you have anything you'd like to ask William?
Well, yes. I mean, you have another trip to Egypt coming up next year, is it?
That's right. We're going back in February 2012. I'm calling this trip Stargate Egypt 2012. I'm really looking forward to it. It's February 14th through the 27th, and we have some spaces available if anybody is interested. I believe that 2012 is the time to be in Egypt. It seems to all be pointing to Egypt as the place where there's going to be a source of tremendous change, and also immense new energies pouring upon the planet will be coming through Egypt.
When you were there, how were the people? How did they treat you when you were there?
Well, Egyptians love Americans, especially. I think they have the same feeling for Europeans in general. They're some of the warmest-hearted, most welcoming people, most hospitable people anywhere on the planet. I mean, I always say that here in Nashville, we're known for our southern hospitality, but boy, people here in Nashville could sure take a lesson from the folks in Cairo and Luxor and, in fact, all over Egypt, because they are so welcoming and so gracious and so friendly.
And do they have wonderful food still going on around the pyramids? How about the Mena House? Has it been rebuilt?
It's being they're renovating the Mena House right now, as I understand. I'm not sure when they're going to have it completed. There's a huge effort right now in Egypt to really spruce things up. They're in the process of building a brand new museum near the Giza Plateau to replace the existing Cairo Museum, which is downtown. All of the temples are getting new visitor centers, and they're really going out of their way to really open things up and really raise the comfort level for the tourists, which is fantastic. Of course, my interest is not so much in the creature comforts, although that's very nice. What I want is access to the temples. And so what we're doing on our Stargate Egypt 2012 tour is we bought private time at several of the temples so that we're going to be the only people there and have an opportunity to really get a chance to explore the temples in a detailed way.
Well, that's wonderful. I'd like to switch our conversation a little bit now to the next human, you know, and what is the next human going to be like, and what's the evolution of our species? Can you take us on a little trip with what you have found out about the spinoffs that have happened? And I think Starseed must have something to do with this.
Well, what I've been seeing is that the thesis of the next human comes from a quote by Albert Einstein when he said that our current problems can't be solved with the current mindset, the mindset that created the problem. It's going to take the next human to come along and solve our problems. So upon hearing that, I'm thinking, well, who is the next human? Where is this being coming from? You have some people that think we ought to just finish off this wild-eyed race that we're in right now to turn ourselves into robots. And they actually believe that we're going to be able to perfect ourselves as humans within the next 15 years by turning ourselves into iBots. And personally, I think we ought to bring a screeching halt to that, because what all of the ancient and sacred traditions talk about is a next level of human, which is a human who has transformed themselves into what we can call a being of light, a light being, or the perfected human. The thinking here is that in the body, we're all in a pupal phase. Spell that P-U-P-A-L, if you like, or P-U-P-I-L. It works either way. We're students. We're here to learn how to transform or metamorphose, or morph is the term that they use in the New Testament, into higher beings. We're looking to become the next level, which is metaphorically symbolized by the butterfly. But the problem is that we're all kind of like those two caterpillars sitting there talking and looking up at the butterfly, and one of them saying to the other, "You'll never get me up in one of those things." We don't believe that we can transform ourselves into light beings. Therefore, we don't live our lives with that expectation. We don't work on it. We don't visualize it. We almost take it for granted that is going to happen. But so many of the traditions suggest that, well, actually, that's a process that's a very natural process. It's encoded within our DNA, this ascension process, the transformation from Homo sapien into Homo luminous or into light beings. That's already within us, but we really need to be doing the work, the mental, physical, spiritual, and emotional work that will unfold that process. And that's what my research is about. I don't profess to have all the answers for how to do this, but I certainly am attempting to find out. And my primary service to people is providing images, especially that are essentially targets that will show us the way. Because a real key, it doesn't matter if you're talking the Tibetan tradition, the Egyptian tradition, even the early Christian icon tradition, they believe that these sacred images can show us the way to do this, that this sacred artwork can actually activate aspects of our mind and our body and our soul that will assist us in this transfiguration or morphing process. And that's what my presentation, Morph and Soul Rising, is about.
So in these different civilizations through time, we've heard about the diamond body and the cloud walkers and the golden body and the cloak of many colors. And this was all about the alchemical change. Is that right?
That's correct. In Tibet, they call it the rainbow body and believe that a high-level initiate can accelerate the frequency of their body, spin it into a vortex of energy that ultimately manifests as five-colored rainbow light. And they call that the great perfection. So actually, perfection is a very important word in my work. It's in virtually every tradition where they're talking about perfecting the body, perfecting the soul. And what it means is to ultimately transform ourselves into light beings. I mean, as you're suggesting, every religious tradition has a name for this next level of human. But unfortunately, these religious traditions aren't cranking out next level humans at a very rapid pace. However, I think that is in the process of changing right now.
one of the things that I have been witnessing for several years are these new kids that are coming on the planet, the indigos and the crystal children. Do you have any experiences that you can share with us about meeting some of these new kids?
Actually, I haven't met enough of them to be able to accumulate many stories in a good while, actually. I mean, my first book that I wrote in 1991. I had read Dr. Raymond Moody's book about the interlife, where he asked the question, in between incarnations, where does your soul go? And so as a result of that, I wrote a book called Junior Cosmic Egg, which was the story of a cosmic egg named Junior who wanted to grow up to become his own universe. And he had to go around looking for the secrets of how he could become his own universe. And his mantra was, well, if he imagined it and believed it and lived it, he could become it. And so with that book in tow, I started going around and talking with parents and these new kids about their experiences with angels and ETs. And I ended up doing several presentations on the Whole Life Expo lecture circuit in the early 90s and was having a great time doing it. And then I read Zachariah Sitchin's book, The 12th Planet, and suddenly took off in another direction.
Yeah, but it all comes, you know, it's all a piece of the tapestry, you know, from what you were tracking then to what you're tracking now. It's a complete story, really. You take all your journeys and you put them up, you know, on a tapestry and look at them, and they all intertwine. It's like Spider-Woman weaving a web of information. And of course, we're in the information age now with the internet. And what I'm finding through the internet and through the information that we give out on this radio show and through our website is that we're contacting people all over the planet that seem to have the same information at some level, and they want to know more. And we have such a large group that listens to our show, and people that are coming to us asking, well, where are the others like myself?
That's
and
right.
One of the things that we're finding through the charts that we do and my discovery of star markings, so we're finding soul groups. We're finding people through charts that have similar markings. You know, when I first did Discovery of Star Markings, I thought, well, that was it. But now I'm into Discovery of Star Markings Part 2. Why? Because there was a group in Ohio that started showing up, and they were all born at different times and you know, different ages. And they started having the similar markings in their charts, and they all pointed to France, René La Chateau area, the Cathars, Jesus, and the Mary Magdalene. And so that group formed. So then the next group was Athena in the 96, and then we had Atlantis. And so now, with the internet the way it is, and the tapestries are growing by leaps and bounds, I just wanted to share that with you because I hadn't had a chance to tell you exactly what we do on our website. But it looks like that we're part of linking up a lot of starseed to these ET experiments, if you want to call them that, or soul evolution, or the new thought, the new human. I think we're connected to that.
That is, yeah, that's really fascinating. I remember reading a book many years ago. I think it was called Up from the Ashes. Are you familiar with that book?
No, I don't remember it.
Okay, so the story is, it's written by a Jewish rabbi who was doing past life regression work on Holocaust survivors. And what he discovered is that many of these Holocaust survivors were reporting past lives as Cathars. And they started telling these stories about how they're a soul group. They called themselves, referred to themselves as the Tikkun Olam, the peaceful ones. And they tell the story that they incarnate en masse whenever evil arises on the planet. They are the first to throw themselves at that evil so that the rest of the civilization can wake up and try to defeat that evil. So the premise was is that in Cathar times, they were called upon to take on the Catholic Church. And, of course, they were persecuted by the Church. As many as 1 million men, women, and children are supposed to have been exterminated in the first European genocide in France from 1200 to 1244. And then what he proposes is that the same soul group incarnated in Nazi Germany, and not necessarily willingly, but they recognized that they were the ones that were going to have to go after Hitler and to be sacrificed by Hitler once again in the second European genocide. So it's a very fascinating story, and I highly recommend that if you haven't seen that.
Oh, well, that really makes sense because of what I'm getting in some of the sessions. Oh, wow, that really, yeah, because when I first started getting, I thought, how many people can be connected to the Cathars? This is ridiculous. I was just kind of going over the cliff here with this information, thinking, how in the world do these people find me? And they all have these markings, and the markings are from the Cathars. It was just mind-blowing when it first started. And it's increasing, you know, every day. And I keep thinking, wow, another one here, another one there. And people seem to rest. They, you know, when I talk to them about it, but I didn't know the story that you just mentioned. But I do say that I always say that the Cathars were bound in their souls to come back as a group to right the wrongs that happened in each civilization. I do say that each time, but I didn't know about Nazi Germany, and I didn't know about the book. So that
right.
makes a lot of sense.
So it's quite possible then that the Cathars were in existence as a soul group even before their time in southern France.
Well, yes, because that same group that I've been tracking has a history in Atlantis.
Okay, there you go. That's fascinating. And you do get a real Atlantean kind of connection or feeling when you're in Rennes-le-Château, in and around that area. It just seems to kind of, I don't know, ooze out of the ground there. I remember the first time I went there, it must have been 1996 or so, and then I wrote a book called Blue Apples, which is all about Rennes-le-Château and the mysteries there and the possibility that there's a portal or a stargate there, and that's what the ultimate secret of Rennes-le-Château actually is.
Well, I know that there's just so much information that's there that hasn't been discovered yet, and of course Renee Barnett, she did the Bloodline, the movie. Did you see that movie, Bloodline, the movie?
I did see that a couple of years ago. Yeah, I had met Renee and Gloria through the making of it. Gloria was kind enough to host me at a couple of her Mary Magdalene events up there in Connecticut. So I got to know Gloria, and I got to know Renee a little bit because she was participating then as well. And how is that movie doing? How is all that?
Well, they're getting ready to, you know, to do some more filming. You know, Renee has now, she's working on Jesse Ventura's conspiracy theory. She's one of the producers of that show.
Oh, fantastic.
And so she's been spending a lot of time doing that. But she's taking off to do this tour in October. And she or Gloria will be on about 10 till the hour. They're going to come on for about 5 minutes and talk to us.
Uh-huh.
So we'll ask them more about what's going on. Ariel, I think I would like to, I know we have a lot of callers and a lot of people in the chat room that maybe would like to ask questions. So why don't we just start with the switchboard? Well, first I'll turn it to you, Ariel, if you have any questions that you would like to ask William first.
Well, yes, and I'd like to, before I ask the question, just remind, we have a lot of people on the switchboard, that if you want to ask a question of William or Lavendar, that you need to press 1 on your keypad so that we know you're waiting to talk and not just listening. And while you're all doing that, I was really interested with the theories and correlations that you were making concerning St. Francis.
Ah, yes. One of my favorite stories.
I thought it was fascinating. Would you want to elaborate on that?
Yeah, where to begin? I seem to, for some reason, research a lot of Catholic mysteries. Having no Catholic background, I guess it's either total sacrilege or heresy on my part, which some of my conclusions, of course, are, or it's like, wow, must have had a past life as a Catholic. I don't know. But I'm very fascinated by that. I came upon the Francis story sort of obliquely, I guess. I had been in Philadelphia. I was researching at that time my book Freedom's Gate, which was about the lost symbols in the dome of the U.S. Capitol. My co-author, Dr. Mark Gray, lived in Philly, and of course, when you're researching the Founding Fathers, the whole Revolutionary War movement originates out of Philadelphia. So we're there, we're in the Athenaeum, we're in all of the various places doing the original research for the book, looking at the documents, studying the paintings, so on and so forth. And I'm in the Philadelphia Museum of Art one day, and I'm suddenly mesmerized by this painting by John Van Eyck of St. Francis receiving the stigmata wounds, the wounds of crucifixion, from Jesus, but he looks in this painting like he's a butterfly. And I'm thinking, I'm just mesmerized by it. It's like, I've never seen Jesus as a butterfly before. And this, of course, is what I was all about with my research into the light body activation research I was doing for Morph, and thinking, wow, now here's a fantastic illustration of this concept of Jesus is actually morphed into the butterfly here, and now he's beaming the stigmata wounds through beams of light, literal beams of light, to St. Francis. I don't know who St. Francis was. And so I just started pulling on that research, and lo and behold, Jesus wasn't a butterfly. He's actually manifested before St. Francis as a seraph, one of the highest order of angels, the angels that live beside the throne of God and are considered to be beings of pure light and pure love. And I just start pulling on that, and pretty soon I've got this enormous collection of Renaissance artwork showing Francis receiving the stigmata wounds from Jesus as a seraph. And I start putting together this whole story of the belief during the Renaissance that humans could morph into seraphs. In fact, that was the highest human aspiration. If we focused exclusively on the love of God, we could become seraphs. And this is why Jesus is presented as a seraph manifesting before St. Francis, who, of course, is later considered to be the second Christ. And so I followed that trail to Assisi, Italy. Well, I always tried the very best I can to, if I'm going to write about something, I have to have been there. I have to go to that place. I have to get my boots on the ground. I have to get my hands dirty. And I have to feel the place and smell the place and taste the place. Otherwise, I don't think my work is authentic as it could possibly be. And so that ended up being one of the most remarkable trips that I've ever taken. My wife Claire and I went on that trip together and explored all of Italy, and ultimately, of course, Assisi, following the trail of St. Francis, which Assisi is where St. Francis lived, and you have the cathedral there at San Francisco, which has some of these depictions by Giotto and others of Jesus as a seraph. And the fun story that emerged from that is we got trapped in a downpour one evening, and we stumbled into this restaurant, just drowned rats. And we sit down at a table, and there's a couple of kind of little old lady types sitting there. Forgive me if that sounds disparaging. It's really not, because it ends up being that these ladies were actually nuns in street clothes, okay? And they sit down, they look at my wife, and she's got this amazing glow about her, and they say, well, who are you guys, and what are you doing? And we said, well, we're here on the trail, following the trail of St. Francis. And what happens is they tell us, well, have you been to the place where St. Francis meditated, and where St. Francis may have received the stigmata wounds from Jesus? And we said, well, no, we hadn't, but we'd very much like to go there. So they gave us some directions. The next day, it took us about 3 hours to find the place. We finally get up to the Hermitage, as it's called, of St. Francis. We go through the gate, and off in the distance, I see this beautiful sculpture. We walk up to it. It's a golden ring that St. Francis is standing within. And to me, that's a stargate. That the golden ring is the symbol for the gateway or the portal. And that was really important to me, because throughout this process, I had seen Jesus as a stargate-traveling time traveler, and this is part of the capabilities that these seraphs possess, these highest order of angels. They can go, be, see, do anything they want. And one of my conclusions was that these guys are they're stargate traveling time travelers. And lo and behold, I get there to Assisi, go to the Hermitage of Francis, and here's this amazing sculpture of St. Francis standing in a stargate.
Wow.
So I felt like at that moment, sort of like E.T. following the Reese's Pieces. It's like you answer the call, you keep following the pieces. Everybody listening, I'm sure, can relate to this. And you never know where it's going to take you. And that's where that story of St. Francis ended up taking me. And I've done extensive research about the Seraph since then. And it's been just a tremendous source of joy and inspiration, but also a huge challenge trying to get a handle on these beings, because I really believe that they are coming back in our world in mass right now. The word seraph means fiery angel or winged serpent. Well, so does Quetzalcoatl mean feathered serpent or winged serpent, the Mayan savior who's due back in 2012. And so I'm thinking that that might be an explanation for why we're starting to see these reports of what could be seraphim manifesting in the skies around the world. And how they manifest is very often the seraphs, they're called the winged serpents or the burning serpents, because they're often connected with bright orange and red lights. And sometimes orbs of that nature, bright orange, bright red. And I'm starting to get reports as I'm talking about the seraphs from people all over the world that are experiencing beings like that, light beings that pulse energy to them that match that description. In fact, when they were working on UFO disclosure a couple of years ago, there were some reports, it was Air Force reports that were released, and these two guys that worked at a nuclear missile silo reported that a being matching that description, orange, fiery orange and yellow, may have been responsible for shutting down a nuclear silo. So that perfectly matches with what you would expect a seraph to do if they enter into our world. They're always beings of light, beings of love, doing peaceful things.
How does that correlate to the Norwegian spiral?
It's kind of a different thing, but I actually had an interesting experience with that Norway spiral business. In a way, I predicted that spiral, which
wow.
was a really interesting story. I don't know if you want to hear that one or not, but I'm fascinated by that whole Norway spiral story.
Yeah, well, tell us about that.
Yeah.
Well, what had happened is I had, back in December of 2009 when that happened, I had been in Tempe, Arizona, giving a presentation about my book, Freedom's Gate, which is about the apotheosis of George Washington, the painting in the dome of the U.S. Capitol. It's the painting that portrays Washington as a deified being, as a human god, as an elevated human, in fact, as a resurrected human. And I was basically an expert on that word, apotheosis, which again, it means to deify, to raise from human to God-man. I get home and I hear a guy talking about the upcoming Copenhagen conference, which is that climate change conference that was to be held in Oslo, or in Norway. And he says, warning, this is a guy named Lord Christopher Monckton was his name, kind of one of these supposed New World Order types, and who's also a whistleblower, apparently. And he says, warning, the apotheosis is at hand. And I'm like, what? And he goes on to say that this climate change conference represents apotheosis. And I'm thinking, you know what, that's a real misuse of that word. That why is he using that word? And the more I thought about it, the more I'm thinking, well, okay, let's just follow this through. This climate change conference is supposed to be about the introduction of a new world order, a one world government that would tell all of us how we can live our lives, from the kind of light bulbs we can use to how much water and energy we can use without being taxed by this global organization that they were going to set up. And so I'm thinking, all right, if he's talking about this one world government is coming, the apotheosis is at hand, which is what he's warning about, then I asked, is it possible that the fulfillment of Christian end time prophecy of this fast talking Antichrist who runs this new world order and us is that also at hand? So according to Christian prophecy, when this Antichrist figure turns up, there will be two other figures who also appear at this time who represent kind of the counterbalance to that figure. These two witnesses, as they're called, are believed to have been Moses and Elijah, who will be reincarnating and reappearing in our world. Well, the last time we see Moses and Elijah is at the transfiguration of Jesus. And what happens is that this represents the apotheosis or deification of Jesus. It's an event in which he takes three of the disciples up to the top of the mountain. He transforms himself into a being of light. And suddenly Moses and Elijah appear beside him as if out of thin air. Over and over again, when you look at Christian art of this event, the Transfiguration, they show Jesus wearing his bright white garment of light, they show Moses and Elijah, and they show a spinning purple wheel behind Jesus. I say wheel because it's sometimes shown as concentric rings. And the idea of the concentric rings convey is actually threefold. It conveys spinning, it conveys sound currents, and it also conveys a portal or a gateway. So based on that, the 1st of December, when I wrote this blog on my website, I said, all right, well, if this is the New World Order and the fast-talking Antichrist is the guy that's going to run this organization, should we be looking, A, for that figure to show up, and B, should we start looking into the skies around Norway for a spinning spiral? 8 days later, what showed up over the skies of Norway but this blue spinning light? And it was just one of those, like, whoa, okay.
That must have been,
and we take it from there.
Astounding for you. I mean,
and then the world press automatically agrees and reports, oh, that's a Stargate. A Stargate opened over Norway. And what was astonishing about it to me was that everybody just kind of agreed. Yeah, Stargate opened over Norway. What's for lunch?
Yeah. Wow. And do you think it was a sign or a functional kind of thing where something actually went from point A to point B?
Yeah, well, I have no evidence one way or another. I mean, that is the question, isn't it? So you've got President Obama, who's in Norway to receive the Nobel Prize. You've got Will Smith, who's there with him, who has all kinds of Hollywood baggage with him from playing roles from Independence Day to Men in Black. And he's interviewing Obama there. They make a really big deal out of it. And it does. It makes me wonder, well, was this a test? Or did something actually come through that wormhole? Or, as you're asking, did something leave? And I don't have anything to say about that. I don't have any research, don't have any evidence, don't even have a speculation about it. It happened. And it's something that I think is still largely unanswered.
I just have to keep watching.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I do know the official rocket explanation was not bought by very many people.
Oh, the Russian...
It was a test missile.
Test missile.
Yeah, I don't buy that, and a lot of people don't buy that.
I saw some things on the internet that suggested that HAARP had something to do with it.
I've seen that as well, and you would think that could be a logical explanation for it, but then there are others that say HAARP had nothing to do with it. So then it just kind of depends. Where do you want to put your belief system concerning it?
Right. Well, you know, the pictures that I've seen of HAARP, definite, you know, HAARP disturbances, they weren't so defined. You know, it wasn't a spiral shape. It was just kind of like, you know, like the Northern Lights, nebulous kind of looking, didn't have a lot of definition to it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it was the definition, I think, that just kind of freaked everybody out. It was alarming. It was scary looking for some.
Well, we do have some callers waiting to speak with you. Are you ready for that?
I am ready.
Okay, thanks. We will go first to Mr. Ralph. Hang on a second. Let me get that microphone turned on. There you go. Hi, Ralph. You're on the air.
Hello. How you doing? It's a great show. William, I'd like to ask you a question about a number one, I'd like to ask you if you've ever seen personally a Stargate, a physical Stargate.
Well, it depends, again, how you want to define that. I believe that we have a Stargate here in Nashville, an actual physical gate, and or what could be one. I've never seen any. I've felt it draw down energy, but I haven't actually seen anybody be transported through it. So what kind of a Stargate did you have in mind?
Well, actually, the question is actually about the Stargate. From what I understand, a physical Stargate that actually was one of the reasons why we went to war in Iraq, that Hussein was supposed to have had and was using. And I was wondering if you knew about that one and any others that are currently being used for nebulous reasons by different governments.
Okay, well, yeah, I give myself credit for breaking that whole Saddam Hussein searching for the Stargate story. I did that back in 2002 on Coast to Coast AM, and it was the result of several years of research I had been doing about Saddam Hussein, primarily in the art newspapers. Saddam, I first had learned back in the 90s, believed that he was the reincarnated biblical king Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar, of course, believed he was the reincarnated Nimrod, the biblical king who built the Tower of Babel, the ladder, tower, or stairway to heaven. And the idea is that in the book of Daniel, Nebuchadnezzar had some kind of a hardware device called the golden image of the beast, but he didn't have the software to make the gizmo work. So what he did is he went to Jerusalem in search of the Ark of the Covenant and the blue sapphire stones and all the various other pieces of the kit, as I like to call it, that will make this gadget go. And he loots and levels the Temple of Solomon, brings the Jews back from during the what becomes the Babylonian captivity back to Babylon. Among them are Daniel, Ezekiel, and three men, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, who are three wise men from the Temple of Solomon. And what he does is he's got this thing called the fiery furnace that's there in Babylon, and it's connected to the golden image of the beast. And he makes a wager with these three wise men that if they can enter that fiery furnace and come back out alive, that Nebuchadnezzar will convert to their religion. So what happens is the three wise men put on their coats, their hats, and their other garments, which I have an explanation for momentarily. They enter the fiery furnace. Nebuchadnezzar and his men gather around it, and they're shocked when the three wise men come back out. Not only are they in pristine condition, they're not alone. The Bible says the Son of God was with them. And in the depictions in ancient Iraqi artwork and early Christian artwork of this event, the early Christians made depictions of it because they believed that Son of God was Jesus, and they show him emerging from this fiery furnace with a magic wand in his hand. And so based on that, I said, wait a minute, this fiery furnace is what we today call a Stargate. We're talking about a zone of frequency or vibration. What's the coat, the hat, and the other garments that these three wise men put on? Well, the hat is what the ancient Sumerians called the Shagura helmet, which means that which makes go far into the universe. The coat is called the Pala garment, the miracle garment, the diamond body, the golden body, the light body. And the other garments are the various other accoutrements that go along with the light body. And the way I interpreted this is that they had transformed themselves into beings of light. They were dematerialized by this force field of the fiery furnace. They traveled to someplace else in the galaxy, maybe the galactic center, maybe the Pleiades, could be Sirius, could be any one of 13 star systems, according to the Tibetans, and they brought him back. And the Son of God stayed for a while. They built whole ziggurats or pyramids to him. They built libraries. And this is the knowledge that Saddam Hussein had been seeking. And as I'm following the story, I'm learning in the art newspapers that, remember those UN weapons inspectors that were going into Iraq? They're coming out of Iraq with their pockets loaded with all these ancient Iraqi antiquities. And the Iraqis are getting upset about it because this is their heritage that's somehow being lifted from them. Saddam wanted to create an amusement park for the ancient Sumerian gods. He wanted to create a tourist attraction in Baghdad. He wanted to reveal this ancient knowledge to the world. Those weapons of mass destruction that we never found was this ancient knowledge that he possessed. And so I started talking about this, and pretty soon everybody is saying, well, Saddam's going for a Stargate or has a Stargate. And I'm saying, yeah, and here's the explanation for it. It's because he believed he was Nebuchadnezzar, and he was rounding up all this ancient knowledge and was attempting to reveal humanity's deepest, darkest secrets, our connection with these ancient extraterrestrials. So that was a huge story. And then what happens is, as with anything, is that the story gets picked up, other researchers run it on down the road, and not to take a negative shot at another researcher, but I just have to tell you that there's an author named David Wilcock who's running around telling this story. He says, yes, his insiders, his highly placed intelligence people tell him that, yes, that story is true. That, in fact, that Stargate that I'm talking about once actually belonged to Moses. And Moses had stolen it from a negative ET force who were using it against us. And that special forces went and recovered that Stargate from Iraq. And if you can believe this, and I can't hardly tell this with a straight face because I think it's so utterly ridiculous, these guys are telling the story. David Wilcock and this insider are telling the story that the actual Stargate of Moses is now in downtown Detroit, Michigan, on display in Hart Plaza. It's not functioning, but it is an extraterrestrial device, and it's, in fact, there for all eyes to see. Personally, I think that story is without merit. It's completely ridiculous, and I've asked David and others to come to Detroit with me anytime, and let's prove once and for all that this either is an extraterrestrial device, or if it's not, then you need to stop telling people and misleading people with this erroneous information.
Great, that's a great answer. Can I ask you the last part of the question again? Do you think that there are governments now utilizing active Stargates for malicious purposes against humanity?
I don't have any evidence of that. I don't claim to have insider knowledge. My personal sense, based upon the research that I've done over 25 years of looking at this and these stories, my answer would be no, they do not. And the reason why I say that is because based on these ancient stories of the gateways, going back to the oldest human story, the Epic of Gilgamesh, which is an immortality tale, Gilgamesh is told by a goddess, Inanna, that he's two-thirds divine, he's one-third human. And if he wants to get through the gate of the gods, which is all of our quest ultimately, then he's going to have to become fully divine. He's going to have to become not two-thirds divine, he's going to have to become fully divine, completely holy, totally pure. In other words, he's going to become a totally compassionate being, a being of light, and a being of love. And I see that over and over again in the ancient Egyptian tradition as well. When they're talking about the gate, they don't want any riffraff out there in the realm of eternity. They're not taking any nuclear missile through any gate of eternity while these star beings are on the watch. And so in my view, movies like Stargate, Dr. Carl Sagan's vision in Contact, which is the militarization of Stargates, is all disinformation. It's completely, in my view, bogus, and I do not believe that the U.S. Air Force has developed the ultimate love device, which would be a Stargate, and I do not believe that they are taking any kind of weapon systems or anything that could potentially be harmful to the universe beyond Earth's orbit through such a gateway.
Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate that.
You're welcome.
Thanks for calling, Ralph. Bye-bye.
And I know a lot of people want to believe that we have this technology, that they've been doing it, and there are this malicious stuff going on. And I'm willing to be convinced, but I have to see it myself before I actually would report on it.
I personally cannot believe that the Galactic Federation and the Councils of Light would ever let the kids play with matches.
No way. Not a
chance.
Know, no
it,
way.
It just, it, I mean... Even our little nuclear power plants, that's where they draw the line, and you know, Gates of Eternity are way far beyond our nuclear power generators, and no, the folks are not going to let the kids play with that kind of stuff, because we're not mature enough, we're not evolved enough, and we're certainly not pure enough to be allowed to even touch that kind of power.
Yeah, I agree. And again, you know, one of the metaphysical messages of the Stargate, a very important one, is that it's about connection. It's about connection among beings in this star system and other star systems. And that's why the ring is such a potent symbol for the gateway, because it, again, is the ring is the symbol for unity. The ring is the symbol for wholeness and holiness. And so the message is that we want to join that ring, and these are ultimately benevolent beings, I believe, and not kids playing with matches.
Right. Well, we have Gloria Amendola on the switchboard waiting to tell us a little bit about the tour. So we're going to bring her on, and then we will be back with William Henry. Hi, Gloria. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you? Thank you so much for giving us the time. And it was interesting to listen to William speak about Stargates. I've studied some of his material, and I was thinking of the connection to Rennes Le Chateau for me. So it's kind of a synchronistic moment, because I just feel that there's something connected to that knowledge in the Rennes Le Chateau region of France as well.
Mm-hmm. No doubt.
And, you know, that's where Renee and I are bringing the Bloodline Mystery Tour, and it's fascinating, if you will. I'm not sure, you know, if in my understanding or my interpretation it's a Stargate or it's star mapping, but I do know in my research I've found that mapping of the heavens on the earth in many sacred locations that hold incredible energy in the earth, and I think that's something that brings Renee and I back to the area over and over. The Saunière mystery is interesting, and of course the Magdalene aspect is phenomenal, but I think it's the earth energy there and the imprint of the stars, especially Venus, the five-pointed star, in the Rennes area that really does it for me on a totally energetic level.
Well, it's going to be a great excursion. So you have some details about that for us?
Sure. It's going to be October 9th to the 15th, and we're going to stay at a very beautiful place called Hotel Levache by the Aude River, the ruins of a temple to Cybele, very highly energetic, living waters, and we're going to be, you know, roaming around different layers of the Rennes Le Chateau mystery, from Saunière and Ben Hammett's findings to the earth energies to the megalithic level of history there, and of course to the Magdalene. You know, and was she there, and where could she have been, and why was she drawn there? And to me, it all goes back to earth energy. So I think it's going to be a fun, exciting tour.
Now, have you changed the date?
We had to change the date because this wasn't a planned tour, but something that just happened. People began to ask us. We did not have availability until October 9th, so it is October 9th to the 15th, 1 week later. And so that's when we'll be going, and we'll be doing our own discovery there. There is a connection to 2012 in the area. It has been called the Refuge of the Apocalypse. Some people believe that's connected to Bougarache Village and Mountain. I'm not so sure if it's there or where it is, but we're going to be roaming around trying to put those pieces of the puzzle together on the ground. Ben Hammett will be joining us and a few other people, so we're pretty excited about it.
Well, you should be. And that's interesting that by moving it a week later, you're going to be there when the sun reaches galactic degree in Libra.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. I know Elenin is very close. I think right around that time, the comet Elenin, if you believe it's a comet, is closest to Earth around that date. I haven't double-checked it, but I think it is. So I guess that's going to be a pretty powerful time there.
It will be one to write about and one to remember. So we'll be looking for your report when you get back. Now, when is the last date for registration?
We're finalizing everything end of this week because it's such a last-minute synchronistic thing where we really think Ren is pulling us there. And with what you just told me, I think I truly understand why. So end of this week is it.
Okay, so by Friday of this week or by Sunday?
By Friday, I'd like to know. And people can contact me, chalice4444@yahoo.com. And if they go to my website, GloriaAmendola.com, on the contact page, they can find full contact details and phone number.
Okay, and that's GloriaAmendola.com.
Correct. Thank you so much.
Okay. Well, thank you for joining us and giving us this update. And I know that we have a lot of our audience is very interested in going, so we will be watching very closely.
Okay, thanks again. Bye-bye.
Okay, thanks, Gloria. Bye-bye. Okay, well, that was Gloria Amendola, co-director of with Renee Barnett, and the tour, make sure you call or email by Friday. We are going to get back now with William Henry. So, Lavendar, we have another caller with a question. Would you like to go there, or do you have a?
No, go ahead. Question? Go ahead. I know we have people that have questions. Go ahead.
May I just say one thing, ladies?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I just Ren Le Chateau, I do think it's a stargate. I mean, even when you're listening to Gloria, she said, okay, it's a place where there's a lot of energy. She referred to it as Earth energy, but she also made the connection with Venus. And so here we are. This is where we're talking about a place, a dot of real estate, where the energy of a star or star system, in this case a planet, is potent, where it's palpable, where you can feel it. And in fact, over the gateway to the Church of Mary Magdalene is the famous inscription, "Terrible is this place." That comes from the book of Genesis, in that episode where Jacob lays his head on the stone and sees the ladder, tower, or stairway reaching into the heavens. And he awakens from his dream of seeing this gate and says, "Terrible, awesome, powerful is this place. This is none other than the gate to God, and this is the gate to heaven." So based on that, right there, we can start to make the connection that, hey, we're talking about an actual gateway place, a stargate. And in my view, when you follow through with the story of Jesus, his ultimate secrets are supposed to be there. That's one of the part of the lore of the area. Some think it's the bones of Jesus, the genealogy of Jesus, the bones of Mary Magdalene. But if it is the ultimate secrets of Jesus that are in Ren Le Chateau, his ultimate secret is how he transformed himself into a being of pure light and pure love and opened a gateway and left and can come and go through that gateway and has done so throughout time.
You know, it just occurred to me that the transformation was because he was the light being to start with, so the transformation was coming into the physical.
You're absolutely right.
Just returned to that. So there were two transformations, one in and
there
one out.
You're right. Yeah, and people used to think, William Henry's had a little too much of the Kool-Aid here when he's talking about Jesus as a stargate traveling time traveler. And then last November, there was a book that was published called The Revelation of the Magi. It's by Dr. Brent Landau. He was a Harvard Divinity School PhD candidate who had heard about this 8th century Syrian Gnostic manuscript that had never been translated into English. It's one of these books that the proverbial books buried in the basement of the Vatican. He goes over to Rome, gets the book, brings it back, translates it into English, and it essentially says three things. One, the Magi are not following a star. the revelation of the Magi, this 8th century Syrian manuscript, Gnostic manuscript, explicitly describes Jesus as a star man or a star child. So they're following a star man. This being, Jesus, star child, takes them to a gate, or excuse me, takes them to a cave where he manifests through a gate. So, gee, what kind of a gate does a star man or a star child manifest through? Sounds like a stargate to me. And The third thing is that he tells the Magi that he's been continuously appearing throughout time in the past and in the future. That's, now we're talking time travel. So here's an 8th century Gnostic manuscript translated by a Harvard PhD that has just given me all the connective tissue that I need in order to put this story together and back up this, what used to be an assertion and speculation of mine, that this is what this story ultimately reveals and what the Christian artwork actually portrays, is his transformation into a being of light, because he was a being of light, and when he temporarily inhabits the skin suit, he's doing that to fulfill a mission, and then what we refer to as crucifixion, resurrection, and ascension is all about him putting back on the light body. And lo and behold, when you see ascension artwork, when Jesus is leaving the planet, he's almost always portrayed in concentric rings that resemble what we today call a stargate. Put that together with the revelation of the Magi, and I think we have a more accurate revelation of the ultimate Christian mysteries.
Fascinating. Well, let's pick up another call here, and if I'm reading this correctly, this call, it was from Area 240, and I believe the caller's name is Seraph. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi.
Did we get that right?
Yes, spelling of my name is S-E-R-A-P.
okay.
And hi, William. Question is that you have you also have a theory about going another dimensions. There is a gateway, and I think you made some relations with the old Egyptians, like they go after they die. With this boat, they go from the other side, and the shape of the boat shows like they go to another dimension. Is that right?
Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. They ride the ship of eternity or the arc of the millions of years, which resembles the way we draw a wormhole today. They sail that ship into eternity, into a place they call the field or dimension of the blessed.
Is there any other gateway in the earth, in the world, that we go to another, we can go to another dimensions, like besides Stargate? Because Stargate, I think the timeline of the Stargate is the same time, but the dimensions are different dimensions, different
well,
places.
Yeah, there's lots of places on the planet that are rumored or thought to be these interdimensional portals or gateways. You have them in Peru. You've got them in Egypt. We've been discussing a potential one in southern France and near Rennes-le-Château.
How about in
really,
Turkey? Do you think there is one in Turkey?
There could be. I don't know of one in Turkey. It's definitely on my list to investigate. Maybe even the Hagia Sophia. I don't know.
Hagia Sophia, yeah. Maybe around that place, yeah, because it's funny thing, before I read your information, before I knew about you, I had a vision about this, the same kind of drawings that you mentioned. And then I was talking to a friend of mine, and he mentioned your name and your site. And when I entered your site and saw this drawing, I was really, really surprised, because it's the same thing, that even the color that I was shown.
Oh,
so I was really fascinated, and I'm from Turkey originally, and I think there is a place in Turkey that it goes to different dimensions. There is a gateway.
Well, I would certainly love to know about that. If you could forward anything, that would be fascinating. And your comment brings up a question that I often think about in relation to this, and that is, the ancient Egyptians had boats that sailed on the Nile. Mm-hmm. On the earthly Nile, that resemble these wormhole boats or the ship of eternity. And my question is, well, which came first, the cosmic shape of the wormhole, like the way modern physics draws it, is that like some kind of an archetypal shape, and is the reason why the ancient Egyptian boats, their earthly boats, resemble wormholes is because this is the ultimate universal shape or symbol for a boat, be it a cosmic boat or an earthly boat.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I think we should think about it.
And another thing about that symbol that fascinates me is when they show the mouth of the wormhole in these scientific drawings, they resemble the bell of a trumpet. You have a mouth and then a throat and then another mouth, and the mouth of the wormhole resembles a trumpet. This is significant because in the ancient world, in alchemical drawings and even going back to the book of Genesis, the trumpet or trump was the symbol of the instrument that joined heaven and earth. The angels played trumpets. And you would see them, for example, in illustrations of Jacob's dream, you'd see the angels on the ladder with trumpets blowing them into his crown chakra. And so the trump, of course, is a Greek word that means tone, wave, or reverberation. And all the good stuff, the ascension, the transfiguration of the human species, the new dawn, the golden age, is all supposed to begin at the last trump. So they're talking about a tone, wave, or reverberation that suddenly, perhaps cymatically, just changes everything on Earth, a new vibration. And lo and behold, the symbol of the wormhole itself has the trumpet within it. I think it's an interesting correspondence. It must be significant.
Yeah, there must be. It's really, really interesting. Okay, all right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Sarah Pitton.
Thank you.
Okay, we are going to go to our chat room and check in with Purple Sage. Hello, Purple Sage.
Hello,
how's
everybody.
How's it going in the chat room? Hello.
Oh, we're just really, we've got about 60 people in the chat room right now, and they're saying this is probably one of the best shows we've ever had. They're so excited. It is a really, really good informational show. Hi, William.
Hello. Hello, everybody. Thank you for being here.
One of the questions is that they wonder if you, William, know of sun cruisers.
No.
Okay, supposedly they are planet-sized ships that have been caught on SOHO images. And apparently have an influence on the sun. Okay, so then we'll move on. The next one is a comment that I wanted to make about a comment, a topic that you were talking about quite a few minutes ago, and it was about the picture that you saw of Jesus being the butterfly. And then you had said that we are the butterfly.
Yes.
And I agree with that. I just wanted to make a comment because I had heard someone say this today, and it just totally jived with me when you said that. There's a whole lot of talk about ascension right now. People are trying to ascend. But the idea is that we are already ascended. We are already ascended masters. So there is no ascending. We are already the butterfly. We just have to remember that.
I was just going to say, yeah, it's more a process of remembering, isn't it?
Uh-huh. Yep, exactly, because we're already there. Another...
I talk about...
Go ahead.
I was going to say, I talk about that in my anointed presentation, that the Gnostics had a trinity of ideas, one that we are essentially divine sparks. We're sparks of the divine, call them star seeds or other terms, divine sparks. And it's our divine spark that grows our human body as a vehicle for manifestation, for moving around in this plane. And part of the object of the awakening process is to connect with your higher self. And that's that part of you that, especially people know their higher self. They know that when they hear that voice of their higher self, because when they're in conflict or they're uncertain, our higher self is always that voice that says, what would you do if you weren't afraid? And the higher self is potentially that light being, that ascended self, that avatar self, that master self. And part of what its role is to do is to lead us to the creation or the acquisition of what's called the robe of glory or the garment of light, the light body. And once we have that, then a part of that process too is gathering all of the liberated seed atoms, gathering all the star seeds together into a central pillar that the Gnostics called Zadok, which means righteousness. These are all the righteous beings, and this doesn't mean they're self-righteous. We all know self-righteous people. These are the righteous are those that speak truth, speak their truth, and are interested in this process of lining humankind up with its highest self. And the idea is that all of these divine sparks gather together to form a pillar of righteousness. And if the pillar is strengthened by our actions, then it continues on and it becomes an immensely potent force in a civilization. But if we don't do the work, then that pillar is, of course, weakened and the civilization suffers as a result. So this is why it's so important for all of the star seeds, all of the seed atoms, the divine sparks to gather together in this way and do this work, because we're actually forming an immense pillar of light that then can be a source of inspiration, renewal, and nourishment, in fact, for all of the star seeds or divine sparks on the planet.
And that's so wonderful. Yeah, another, when you talked about getting in touch with our higher self, there are so many people out there that are trying to get in touch with the angels, get in touch with the star beings, get in touch with ascended masters, what have you. And I don't say that that's bad. I think that's lovely. But I think probably the most important being for anyone to get in touch with is their higher self. Do you agree?
I absolutely agree. And one way to connect with that aspect of ourselves is, first of all, is to listen to that. They call it the still small voice. There's lots of different names for it, but just to listen is very important. But also, when we're operating through our higher self, very often our actions are those of joy, love, peace, sharing. And so if you want to connect with or get the attention of your higher self, logic says, well, maybe you start including more and more of those activities in your daily itinerary or activity, and that will get the attention of our higher self. It'll start really getting excited and will make its presence even more fully known to you.
Yeah. Thank you. The question just came in. If you have time, they would like you to talk about the grail that showed up in photos recently.
Oh, yeah. I had a fascinating conversation on my radio show Revelations with Dr. Carmen Bolter. She had been in Egypt, Giza, the pyramids, back in November of 2010 and took a series of photographs that appeared to show what she interpreted as a wine glass or even a grail chalice. They were these lights that manifested around the pyramid, and she captured them with her digital camera. And what was fun about it is that Carmen kept calling them a wine glass or a chalice, and I kept thinking to myself, well, I don't see a wine glass or a chalice in these photos. Excuse me, I see a wormhole. And in fact, you could interpret it either way. It does look like a wine glass or a chalice, but it also, these lights also resemble wormholes. And these match some photos that I had included in my Soul Rising presentation, which I put out last October, that were taken in Arkansas and also here in Tennessee, that show the exact same thing. And I cited that as evidence that, hey, you know, we keep talking about this new consciousness that's coming along. And to me, evidence of this new consciousness is the proliferation in movies and TVs and elsewhere of wormhole symbolism, because it represents the next level of human consciousness. It represents doing the impossible. The idea, A, that we can turn ourselves into light, into light beings, that's impossible to some, but we're doing that. And further, the idea that we can travel the stars through stargates and wormholes, that's impossible to some. But evidence suggests that advanced beings have been doing that in the past, and we are on the verge of duplicating that. And so, in fact, we're on the verge of doing the impossible. So I cite the appearance of such symbolism as tangible evidence that this shift in consciousness is unfolding right before our very eyes.
So you were in Arkansas in last October?
I wasn't there, but there was a group that met in Arkansas on 10-10-10, and these photos were taken at this event, and someone who was there sent them to me.
Okay, because we were there, too, and I thought, oh, my gosh, that would be just too much of a coincidence.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, Purple Sage, go on with your – you have more questions from the chat room?
Well, the portals was a big discussion. And some people have seen the same thing that I do, so I'm going to describe to you what I see. And I have a question about that. I don't see it all the time, but I see it often enough that I recognize it when I see it at night before I'm just about to go to sleep. I look up at my ceiling and I see this hole. It's a definite hole. It looks like I'm looking through water, and I can see either the sky or other things that come up through it. Is that a portal?
Yeah,
I mean,
absolutely.
They can be in our bedroom.
They can be anywhere.
Like, okay, can it come and go?
Yes.
Okay. Can it be, for instance, can you take a picture of a place and you won't see it with the naked eye, you won't see it in the camera, but when the camera film is developed, you will see it?
Yes, people report that not frequently, but it's becoming more and more common. Let me put it that way.
Okay. Thank you very much for answering my questions.
Thank you.
That's it for right now.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, and I think we may have time to check back. So if you have another other questions coming from the chat room, we'll be back in a little while.
Yep. Okay.
Okay. Thank you so much, Purple Sage.
Oh, bye-bye. You're welcome. Bye.
Okay. Well, we have our switchboard host, Tammy, has a question, and I think I will let her ask you herself. Hello, Tammy.
Hello. Yes, William, I would like to know more about the Anointed that you're having in September.
Oh,
you're
fantastic.
Gathering in Nashville.
Right. Thank you for asking about that. That presentation is going to be brand new. It's something that I'm very excited about. It comes out of a story. It's one of these Gnostic stories. It involves an Old Testament figure whose name is Enoch. And Enoch, of course, is mentioned in the Old Testament. He's considered a sage. He's a wise man. He lived before the time of the flood. And he was like us. He's an investigator. He's a researcher of this lore and this symbolism, and also very interested, by the way, in portals. Suddenly, Enoch finds himself on the radar of the Archangel Michael. And the Archangel Michael takes Enoch into the heavenly realms. And it's to Enoch that the book is the second Enoch that explicitly describes the transformation of Enoch as one which blurs the boundaries between human and angelic existence. What happens is Enoch is taken into heaven by Michael, and Michael takes Enoch and strips him of his earthly clothes and anoints him with the holy oil. And this oil then clothes Enoch in the garments of glory, is the term Second Enoch uses. And as Enoch looks at himself, he, as he describes, was one of the glorious ones, and there was no difference. The word glory means glow rays. It to be glorious means to glow rays, to become a glowing being, a shining being, just like all the other deities, the angelic beings. And the question, the power pack driving the anointed is, what kind of an oil can you put on the human body that turns it into light, that turns a mortal into an angel? And where can I get some? That's what this presentation is about. And so what I do is I begin with the stories, not the stories, but the history of Akhenaten and Nefertiti, their use of this oil and its connection with the sun. And I take it up through the story of Jesus and Mary Magdalene, who anointed Jesus with what I believe was this very same oil. And so the question is, what is this oil, and what was it? What was its role in the story of Jesus? Well, its role was it transformed him into a being of light, just like has happened with Enoch. And I take it all the way up into the modern day, and a look at the possibility that we could be on the verge of recreating this oil. In fact, what happens is, in another story involving this oil and the Archangel Michael, Adam is sick, and he sends Seth, his son, back to the Garden of Eden to get the oil from the Tree of Life so that he could heal him. And the Archangel Michael says, sorry, Seth, I can't give it to you right now, because that oil is meant, one, to assist in the journey home and to transform us into celestial beings or star beings. So it's not necessarily an earthly panacea. It's not just for healing earthly ills. It's more for turning us into star beings. And secondly, he says, it's for the end times. It's not for now. It's for the end times. So if you're interpreting the end times as the Bible does, as Revelation chapter 20, verse 12, or Revelation 20, 12, and you allow that to coincide with the Mayan calendar that comes to a close on December 21st, 2012, it's possible that Michael is telling Seth this oil is going to be made available in 2012. And that's part of what my supposition, that's what the research is about. And so the Anointed is a presentation I'm giving here in Nashville, September 9th through the 11th, in which I will be revealing all of this research, because to me it's an exploration that all of us need to be undergoing. And we need more than just me looking at this. We need a lot of people looking at it and figuring out just exactly how we can do this. And I've got a bunch of clues that I've been following that I will be sharing. And it's, to me, an extraordinary story, an extraordinary search. And I invite everybody to come to Nashville, if you can, September 9th through the 11th.
Oh, yes. I'll be on your website checking that out. Thanks for explaining. This is just fascinating. I'm going to try and be there.
Okay, wonderful. Love to have you.
Well, thank you much, William.
Okay. Thanks, Tammy. Okay. Well, we have our very own Miss Doc Belva, who works with our Starseed audience. She is our resident health expert, and she has a question for William. So where are you? There you are. Hello, Belva. How are you?
Hi, darling. How are you?
We're doing
this
great.
This is a wonderful show. This is one of the very best.
Well, thanks to William.
I know.
Thank you.
Right?
Thank you very much.
I wanted to ask him, in 81, I was in Egypt for my first visit, and I went to the Temple of the Crocodiles. Have you been there?
Yes, I have. Komombo, right?
Yes. And I found a secret room, and there was 250 of us in this tour.
Oh,
and only one man found me in there. And I was in a place that had a stone telephone booth.
Oh, my gosh.
So I'm in there trying to decide, what is this? And what kind of a room is this? And there was a table where you could put maps. And if you got into this booth, which was made, was huge and was made out of stone, but it only held one person, I thought it was a traveling place where you could go back to the Pleiades or someplace, providing you had the ability to contact other people. And I almost, when this man walked in, he said, "What are you doing in here?" I said, "I really don't know, but I feel very fortunate that I was led to this place, because no one else came in there, only me and this man." It was very strange and very, well, I read my body a lot, and I have a lot of recalls. And I lived at a time when with Akhenaten and Nefertiti, so I know a lot about all of that. But it was, that one blew me away. The whole trip, that blew me away. And the last day of the trip was the day that Reagan was shot.
Wow.
And I was getting ready to get on the plane, and we got the message that Reagan had been shot, and we all rushed to the pyramid. It was amazing. It was just absolutely amazing. The whole trip was amazing.
Oh, yeah, sure. You know what I tell people? Go ahead.
Go ahead.
To me, many of us have had past lives in Egypt, I feel, and Egypt remembers. So it's kind of like when you enter the temples, you're always walking across red granite as the altar stones and at the entranceway to each of the temples. And red granite is, they call it the fire stone because it's loaded with pure quartz crystal and it holds energy and vibration. And part of me thinks that when you enter into those temples, when you cross over that threshold into the temple, your body is sort of like the credit card going through the swipe machine at the grocery store, that the temple is scanning you and it's like, "Oh yeah, you over there. Come over here. Come into this room. Remember this? Let's remember you were working on this. Let's get back to work about this and take it forward from where you left off." I really believe that that's what's happening, and that's why on my tours I try to.
I certainly had that feeling. I had that feeling.
Yeah.
Because
so that's
my
why...
name was Ty.
Uh huh.
I was a black girl from the Sudan, and
wow.
Amenhotep III married me.
Wow.
Because he wanted the land between Egypt and Africa. He wanted that piece of land.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my dowry. So when I saw my pool, I saw all these things, and then I found my bathroom.
Wow.
It's in the Egyptian Museum downtown. And it has papyrus. And it has all the things. I had seen it so many times before, and I didn't know where it was. And the girl that was with me, I said, "Oh, my God, here's my bathroom." And then I found my mother's head and my father's head. They had them under glass, and it was, and a lock of my hair, and I used henna on my hair. I knew I did. And they had a big thick piece of my hair under a glass. It was the most amazing thing. I couldn't believe it. It was a blown away trip. It really was.
Wow. Well, we know you've had quite an amazing lifetime, Velva, and I'm sure that like William said, Egypt remembers.
Yes. Yes.
That's fascinating. Well, thank you for sharing that with us. And as
well,
always,
I just wanted him to know I saw a phone booth. It looked like a phone booth. It was made out of
transformation chamber, right?
Yeah. Yes.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's all about that vibration again, because many of those stone chambers she's describing, they're made of red granite, and they are extraordinary sound devices and vibrational devices.
It vibrated when I touched it with my hands, it vibrated.
Oh,
and
sure.
It was a huge rock. I mean, huge.
Mm-hmm.
All carved out of just one stone.
Yeah.
I brought 5 stones from Egypt on that trip. back with me 5 different groups of stones because I had friends that were very empathetic. And I said, I want to share my trip with you. And so some of the stones came from the pyramid. Some of the stones came from that particular temple. And Hannah Kroger was one of the ones. I brought a series of stones, and I told her where each stone was from. And I said, now you can hold the stone and go where I was.
Absolutely.
So that was my present to a lot of people. It was
well, Belva,
exciting.
Thank you so much for sharing another amazing story from your life, and we're going to go and check back with the
good.
Chat room one
okay.
more time before we go on. But thank you
thank
so
you,
much,
William.
Sweetie.
Thank you.
Bye bye. Okay, folks in the chat room, we are coming back your way. So if you have a question for William, now would be the time. We're going to talk to Purple Sage once more. Hi, girl.
Hello. I have 2 questions here. William, are the Archons also known as the Greys?
There is a line of thought that the Archons, or the rulers, as they call, they're described in the Nag Hammadi scroll, the hypostasis of the Archons, or the reality of the rulers. And I think it's John Lash is the guy that pretty much is the one who's made that connection between the Archons and the Greys. And it sure makes sense to me. They're described as beings that don't have a divine spark. They want ours, and they seek to steal our divine sparks from us.
Ooh. Okay. And also, could you give more information on the serpent ropes and the Mayans? And the reason I ask is because one of our listeners has been photographing something that they believe might be these serpent ropes, and their history involves a lot of energy work with the Mayan calendar.
Yeah, fascinating. I've been talking about the serpent ropes since, I don't know, around 2002 or so, and it's hard to believe that now it's 2012 already, and here we are going to see what actually might manifest. But my friend and colleague, John Major Jenkins, is the one who started talking about the Maya serpent rope concept. There are illustrations that he has found in Mayan codexes. I think it's the Codex Bindodonensis is the one that this one in particular I'm describing comes from. And if I'm mispronouncing the word, forgive me. But what it shows is the center of the Milky Way galaxy symbolized by an 8-rayed wheel. And then there's this sort of umbilical cord that emerges from it. It's got markings on it that indicate that it seems to be spiraling or rotating. And riding upon this serpent rope is Quetzalcoatl, the feathered serpent, the Mayan savior figure, or the presumed Mayan savior figure. Well, what John had said in his book, Maya Cosmogenesis, is that he felt that it's possible that you can take out the archaic Mayan term serpent rope, put in the modern word wormhole, and you have an accurate description of what the Mayans might be saying is going to be one of the primary events of 2012, that a wormhole or a stargate is going to open from the center of the galaxy, and this seraph, this winged serpent, this angelic light being, Quetzalcoatl, will be riding upon it. My comment about this is that's extraordinary because, well, how could the Mayans have known that as we turn the wheel here at 2012, how could they have known that the Stargate or the wormhole would represent the apex of our science fiction and even our science? I mean, it represents potentially the salvation of our species. If we can get a hold of this ancient sacred science, it changes everything. And it seems like in their symbolism, that's what they're indicating. And what I've been doing since then is looking around at other examples of serpent ropes. And the most astonishing ones to me are those images of Jesus. When he's sitting on his throne, he's also shown with this umbilical cord linking that heavenly place with earth. And it suggests to me that maybe there's really some true or validity going on this story here, that we might be talking about a time where we start to see these Stargate traveling time travelers starting to pop in and out of our world.
Okay, that's really interesting. And that's all the questions I have for right now. Thank you, William.
Okay. Thank you so much, Purple Sage. And we have one more caller that just came on. Hang on a second. We're going to talk to Felipe here in a second. Hello, Felipe. You're on the air.
Hi, Ariel. How are you? I guess I'm the last-minute chopper, huh?
Yeah.
I'm glad I make it. I don't really have a question. I'm really, delighted. Excellent program, William. I appreciate all your input. I just want to make one comment that with all due respect, I don't have the authority for all this, but a lot of it is gearing up to the December 21st to 2012. According to the work of Carl Kaliman, the actual end date for the Mayan calendar is October 28th of 2011. I believe, and I've been doing some research, that having it as a target date, December 21st of 2012, has been produced by the global elite to detour the attention of the masses, to wait till the big changes and the major shifts to happen until December 2012, when actually in the next 8 weeks before October 28th of this year, there's major changes happening. The time acceleration that the Mayans speak of, since we entered into the ninth wave as of March the 9th, is huge. So I just really, with all due respect, I wanted to really bring to the forefront to the Starseed audiences that the actual end date for the Mayan calendar is October the 28th, 2011. And anyone can do their own diligence and their own work research, that the huge happenings, not only on a local level of our planet, the solar system, the entire galaxy, they're around the corner. They're really right in front of us. And I just want to say that, all of this work that you're doing, and it's just the raising of the frequencies of the vibration of not just the planet, the human race, our DNA, and all of that, is giving us the connection, the awareness of the consciousness of what is really happening, because all of the veils, the multidimensional veils are being dropped as we speak. So this is a great, exciting times for all of us. I commend you, William, for your work. Keep up the work, because there's so many people out there that still don't have a clue. So I honor you for your work, and I thank everybody, and appreciate it. Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you, Felipe.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye. Well, I get Lavendar back because we have, I think, gotten through all of our questions. And I got a phone call. This is a little off the subject, but maybe not. I got a phone call today from my brother who lives in Maryland. And he said, oh, my God, we just had an earthquake. And it was in Virginia, 5.9. And it went, and he actually, stuff was falling off of his shelves, and he lives between D.C. and Baltimore. So I was just...
That's the founding fathers rolling over in their graves.
Good one. Yeah, I like that explanation the best of all. I'm sure they are. But with that in mind, I would like everybody in the following, in the days to come, in between now and the next week, to really hold your vibration steady and be centered and balanced, stay in alignment with your higher self and your guides, your high command, and hold the energy high with the highest intent for the health and the well-being of the earth itself.
Yeah, I agree. There's a very popular radio guy here in Nashville. His name's Dave Ramsey. He does financial consultations all day on CNN and that. And his advice is very applicable here as well. I mean, he talks about the stock market roller coaster, and his advice, I think, applies to the 2012 roller coaster too, and that is nobody gets hurt unless they jump off the roller coaster. And so the idea is, let's enjoy the ride. Let's stay calm. We signed up for the ride. We bought the ticket. We're rolling. It's happening. So let's just enjoy what we're doing. Enjoy the ride. And if it helps, think about what's at the end of the ride, the joy, celebration, the excitement that we're going to have when the ride is over, because then we're going to want to do it all over again.
Right. Well, I'm sure that everybody should realize that, like you said, we signed up for this. We came, we chose to be here during this time, and it is a time to rise and shine,
mm-hmm.
and not shrink and hide.
Exactly.
So, stand in your own light and know that none of us are alone, and we all have a host of higher beings that help and guide us. So, Lavendar, we're just about to wrap up, and I would like to, on behalf of our entire audience and people that will be listening over the next week, I'd like to thank you, William, so much for sharing your time with us this evening and your incredible work. I do hope that you continue and come back sometime when you can.
Anytime. I really enjoyed talking with everybody. Thank you all for listening. It's my pleasure. Let's just make today the best day we can. Let's make next week, next month, next year the very best. And that's what we're here to do. So thank you all for giving me an opportunity to share some of these thoughts with you. And I look forward to talking with you again.
Thank you.
Well, it was our pleasure. Remember to visit williamhenry.net. You could spend all day on that website. There is so much there. So dig in and enjoy. And your radio show, how do we tune into your radio show?
My show is Revelations. It's heard on unknowncountry.com. I post new shows every Wednesday.
Wonderful. Unknowncountry.com.
That's correct. That's Whitley Strieber's website.
Okay, great. Great. So catch William's show is on every Wednesday at what time?
We post it around 2 o'clock Central Time. And
you post the show, and then it's available to be listened to any time after that.
That's right. And so my recent interview was with Giorgio Tsoukalos, who's the producer of the History Channel program Ancient Aliens.
Oh yeah.
Which I was on Ancient Aliens last week, and I'll be on 4 episodes this summer. So look for that.
That's right. You know, I read that on your website, and with all the a vast amount of things that you have to talk about, I failed to bring that up, and I'm glad that you did. So check out Ancient Aliens. That's on the History Channel, is it?
That's correct, on Thursday nights.
On Thursday night, check out Ancient Aliens and see William there. And his name, your guest for this week is
Giorgio Tsoukalos. Who's the producer and star of Ancient Aliens. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, he's got some incredible thoughts and work as well. So thank you so much. Check out Stargate Revelations is the name of the show, and Stargate Radio.
Yes.
At unknowncountry.com and williamhenry.net. William, on behalf of our staff and team here at Starseed Radio Academy, Lavendar, we thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. And join us next week, everybody, same time, Tuesday at 7 o'clock. Lavendar, I will talk to you next week. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
You
You've been listening to Starseed Radio Academy. Visit our website at www.starseedhotline.com.